All right, hello.
Hi, Rosina.
So your name is Ram Das Batchelder. Did I say that correct?
That's right, Ram Das Batchelder.
Batchelder. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'd never seen that name before, the last name, Batchelder. So I wasn't certain if I was pronouncing that correctly or not.
But you got it.
Okay, well, it's nice to meet you. For our listeners, Nikki tried to interview you in April, I believe it was, and you were in India at the time, and the connection was terrible. In fact, I even sat down and tried to edit it to maybe, you know, have something salvageable, and I ended up just giving up.
No, it was a disaster, unfortunately. Alila, as we would say in India, means a play of God, an inexplicable dance of craziness. Oh, dear. Yeah.
So this time you are right here in the U.S. of A. You're in New Jersey right now, I understand.
Yes.
And so hopefully the sound will go a little better for us. Two things I can say about you before we get started is, one, you are a devotee of Amma, the hugging saint, and of course many
yes.
people will be familiar with her, and in fact you live at her ashram, true?
Yes, in India, for the most part.
Okay, mm-hmm. And then also you're the author of a book called Rising in Love, My Wild and Crazy Ride to Here and Now with Amma, the Hugging Saint. That's quite a title.
Yeah, it's a mouthful. Mm-hmm.
But I did look, if you just search for Rising in Love, it comes up. There's another book that comes up as well with that title. But then, you know, you'll see the, you know, anybody who's searching would see the My Wild and Crazy Ride, and they would know which one to get. So,
yes.
Yeah, so searching for Rising in Love is enough.
Well, yes. There's also a website I can give you while we were mentioning it.
Oh, sure.
www.rising-inlove.org.
Okay,
rising-inlove.org.
Rising-inlove.org. Okay, great. And then the book is available there as well. Perfect. Okay, well then, what I would like to do to get started, I would like to get to know you and your spiritual path first. That's where I would like to begin.
Uh-huh.
I do know a little bit, in order to kind of study up on you, I watched your Buddha at the gas pump interview, so I know a little bit, but I think I want to move in a slightly different direction than Rick did in that interview, so this won't be a duplicate of that. But I do think we need to start with a little bit of your story, just so people know who they're listening to. So why don't you just begin telling your story, and we'll go from there.
Okay, well, when I was young, I was brought to church, but basically, and I had a sort of a natural faith in God when I was a child. But basically, my family, the belief system in my family was, it was very important to become a good person, but we didn't really believe any of this about the miracles. And God is a nice idea, but we don't really believe it. So we grew up sort of Christian/atheist. And rather rapidly I picked up the idea that it was all baloney. And by maybe 13 I was pretty much established in atheism and became more and more cynical. And I was a young theater student and went to a theater conservatory, and was very unhappy. I was in psychotherapy trying to find out why I was so miserable, trying to uncover some kind of charisma that I had definitely lost in my childhood, trying to become a better actor. And at some point, the combination of psychotherapy, theater work, and marijuana sort of exploded into some epiphanies. Well, suddenly, I'm getting this whole new level of consciousness coming in. Oh, and I'm living in this new level of consciousness for a few days at a time. Then it would fade. And this began, getting sort of accelerating. And suddenly, one night, there was this sort of a revelation. The walls of the mind came crumbling down, and God was revealed as the supreme totality that was speaking to me and making me laugh and establishing this extraordinary kind of communication with me. So suddenly, I hadn't even believed there was a God. Suddenly, God is speaking to me and revealing himself to me in an extraordinary way. And I had no background for this. I had no preparation for this at all. I didn't know there was a spiritual path. I didn't know anything about saints, enlightenment, spirituality. All I knew was, you know, from my Sunday school training, well, Jesus, you know, was the only divine being that ever came to the earth, and then there were 2,000 years of spiritual drought, and finally, me! You know, God had chosen me, and it was very real. God did definitely choose me for something, but tapping me on the shoulder very vigorously, and yet I did not have the proper understanding to accommodate this, and there was very little for me to choose from in the culture I grew up in that would explain this other than the Messiah concept. Oh, well, gosh. One of my experiences was I met an angel. And when I would smoke a joint, suddenly I was glowing with a visible light, which people who had never before seen an aura would look at me and go, oh, my God, you're him, aren't you? There were so many experiences of this kind, but it was really bizarre. A bizarre period of my life, and I rapidly fell into the delusion that I must be the Messiah because I was having all these experiences. And, was pretty damn near crazy for a couple of years. I was on a Messiah trip for 6 months, fell out of that into a suicidal depression. Oh my God, I've gone crazy. What happened? I ruined my life. I thought it was what? Oh my God, what a joke. You know, what a loser. I fell into self-hatred, right? And then, you know, after 6 months of wading through hell, went back into another Messiah trip, the energy coming in again, full blast, you know, and then again another depression, and then finally I discovered meditation.
Okay, I'm going to pause before we get into the meditation. Yes. So I know that your original experiences began happening when you were getting high. Now, when you were depressed, were you also getting high during that time? Were you getting high both during the highs and the lows?
No, in a way, I quit when you know, like it was the shift between the Messiah thing and the depression was that when suddenly things had gotten so ugly in my life and that the weed no longer would make me high, I would only get more depressed. So then I would have to just stop smoking, and what was the use of it? And I crashed completely into sort of a self-hatred thing.
Okay.
Because I was using the divine energy that was being given, which was very real, but I was using it for the ego's purpose. I was using it in ignorance of what it really was. I was not the Messiah. So sorry. I was the beginner, you know. And so because I was operating under this delusion, and my ego was seizing the energy for it to show off.
Yeah.
You know, look. You know, when we're getting together with an old friend, hey, you want to smoke a joint? And then blowing their mind because they're standing, suddenly I'm visibly transfigured, you know. I mean, it was a very unusual phenomenon, but it didn't help me.
Okay, so.
So, you know.
Well, I was going to say, so what I'm interpreting, and you tell me what you think of my interpretation, how does that sound? What I am interpreting is there was a genuine tapping on the shoulder that was happening there.
Oh, yeah.
A genuine tapping, right, because it changed your life. So it's a genuine tapping on the shoulder. But again, because you had no framework, ego seized it. And that's why you called it a delusion a moment ago. That's why you called it a delusion. Because even though there was a legitimate tapping on the shoulder, the experience as a whole wasn't completely pure. It had a lot of other stuff mixed in
with it.
That's
right. Okay. That's right. And basically, I was just simply ignorant of the spiritual path.
Yes.
I wasn't the Messiah. You know, if this had happened in India, you know, in some fiction in a lifetime, if I was in India having such an awakening, very likely I would meet somebody who would say, oh, no problem, you come meet my guru. You've just had the beginning. It's a very auspicious thing. You will here, take this photo of my guru and meditate. He will appear before you. And then it's an introduction to the real spiritual path. But there was nobody in my life with any knowledge of this. I was the only one who knew anything about God in my life.
Yes.
You know, there were talk about God, but basically no one believed a word of it from what I could tell. So suddenly God is the most real thing in the world appearing in my life. And nobody knew anything about it. And I was like, I didn't know there was a spiritual path. You know, so it was suddenly my ticket out of craziness and out of all that major suffering and confusion was discovering the books about the saints of India.
Okay, so let me ask you a couple other questions before we move on. So
you
were getting high. Right? And yet you had this experience. What, because you seem like a reasonable, intelligent man. So why did you perceive this as at least somewhat of a real experience. We know that the ego got a hold of it and blah, blah, blah. But the part that was the real experience, why did you perceive that as a real experience? Why did you go from atheist to believing that there was something, rather than just thinking, oh, it was the drugs? What quality did it have that made you accept it?
Gee, it's kind of hard to explain it, but it was extraordinarily powerful. And it was based on truth. It was, what happened was somehow the seed of yin and yang got planted in me, and I have no idea where I got this. I didn't read it from a book as far as I know, but it was like a philosophical blossoming, which was that you can take anything, you can take any concept and find its, that we call it yin, and find its match, we call it yang, and the two fit together to create a wholeness, and then there is a wholeness that transcends that yin and yang, which I call the yin-yang wholeness, which is like the union of yin-yang, but one level up. It's like the supreme oneness. And this, you know, in Hinduism, you could call it Shiva and Shakti as the yin and yang, and then Paramatma, the supreme divine self. And I somehow, this, you know, maybe from a past life, this knowledge was just there, and it just came, you know, roaring into my life like a train. But suddenly, boom, boom, everything, this blossomed, like everything I saw became a yin, and everything else became the yang that would combine with that to make the totality, and then I am that supreme totality, which is the union of that yin and yang, and yet beyond them both.
Okay, and so
this, it was an instant ticket. It was a very powerful form of spontaneous meditation that was going on, which just took anything in the world and turned it into an affirmation of I am that, and I am the union of that with its apparent opposite, and I am that which transcends both, and I am that supreme totality. And this was what God showed himself to be to me, the supreme totality, which is the union of all apparent opposites.
Yeah.
The supreme oneness, which includes all duality. So this just blossomed in me, and it would lead to such extraordinary states. All I can say is there was no doubt that it was true, and true in a way that nothing else in my life came anywhere near that truth.
Okay.
It was so powerful that it was like, I didn't care what anyone thought or said. This is the reality, and I'm giving myself to it because there's no choice. God has shown me that he is, and that there is nothing but that, and he's chosen me to reveal his knowledge to. Wow. And it was an incredibly heady time. I mean, it was awesome, and, you know, very quickly led to tremendous delusion and comedy.
Well.
Because, you know, someone called the campus psychiatrist on the day that I met the angel, and he came over, and I tried to explain to him about yin and yang using the chocolate and vanilla cookies on the table, and for some reason he didn't understand, and he didn't understand about the angel I had just met named Serenity, and insisted that I give him my parents' phone number, and I, at that point, began to get annoyed, and the line from the book is, like a Brooklyn-born Jesus with the money changes, I evicted him from the temple of my apartment with some vigorously pronounced profanity. And within 10 minutes, the police were there in a police car, bursting into my room and dragging me into a mental hospital.
Well,
with the siren blazing, da-da-da-da, you know.
Yeah.
And,
Oh, that's okay.
Now, when we got to the mental hospital, I talked my way out the door within about an hour.
Okay.
So I was never admitted there. I just realized, well, this is not the time to wax biblical. It's time to get serious about not getting caught in this trap. So let's just simply come back to square one here. I'm not crazy. I'm just having a little spiritual awakening. I've been working on this little drawing of a yin-yang being. It's really nothing to worry about, doctor. Why don't you just let me go free? I'm fine.
Yeah.
And, you know, he agreed.
Okay, good.
So, you know, and then the next day, I met an old friend of mine from high school, and we got together the next afternoon, and before I had said anything about what I had just gone through, he told me, listen, Mark, I got to tell you something. That was my name in the early days. I don't want to blow your mind. It's pretty far out, but, you know, last week I was up on Lookout Point, and I had a vision of an angel. And then last night I was up again, and I had a vision of an angel with Jesus, and they gave me a mission. It was pretty obvious to me that this was a sign that what I had just experienced with meeting an angel was genuine. I was being brought right together with someone else who had just had an angel experience. So it was one of many signs. that, you know, it was genuine what I had experienced and that I was being supported and led along the path, you know.
Okay. So at some point then, I think this is where we were starting to go. At some point then, again, you have this original tap on the shoulder mixed with a lot of delusion and ego ideas, right? And then at some point, sincerity creeps in. Is that what happened?
Well, it was just a delusion. Delusion being, well, I'm experiencing something, therefore I am the Messiah.
But I mean,
how did you the second coming of Christ?
But how did you move from the delusion? Like, what woke you up from the delusion is my question.
Well, for one thing, falling out of the delusion into a 6-month depression did a lot to sort of hammer that delusion away.
Okay.
But you know, the sense at the time the preciousness of the sense of being, of this communion that was coming, of the divine experience, the energy, the bliss, the sense that God was in me, in my body, you know, was so precious that it was like I wanted so much to have that again because it was so true. So then, you know, finally found my way out of the depression, you know, having burned off all the karma from the wrong interpretation of things. And then the energy comes back in again, and I'm just determined to keep it and grow in it, you know. But again, I didn't have the right knowledge. I didn't know what the path was, and I was trying to go without marijuana for a while, and then I started doing it again because it gave me that instant glow. And I had so many experiences, but finally, you know, it had to be done clean. And I had to discover the great fact, I had to discover the spiritual path. You know, so when I discovered some books about the Hindu saints, was like instantly, oh my God. You know, I'm reading about Neem Karoli Baba, the guru of the famous American Ram Das and Krishna Das. And suddenly I realized, oh, well, you know, I'm not the Messiah after all. That's really obvious because this guy is light years ahead of me. And he's not claiming to be the Messiah either. He's just doing his thing, but he's omniscient. He can manifest objects at will. He can appear in 6 different places at once. He knows the thoughts of everyone all around him. He can ascend into the air and do all kinds of games. I mean, wow, that's a Christ-like being. I'm nothing compared to that. I mean, I'm lucky if I can get through the day. You know, here I am, a mess. I can hardly keep my room clean, you know. And I'm thinking, I'm the Messiah? Forget it. Obviously, I'm just, you could say, a talented beginner, because sure, I had an awakening and the special effects that came with it were unusually potent, but that's not the same as being the Messiah. So it was suddenly just an education. Oh, I thought I was that, but I was completely wrong. I'm a beginner on the spiritual path. Okay, that's great. Oh, good. Now I no longer have the responsibility for leading the entire world to liberation. That's fantastic. Now what I obviously need to do is start meditating, get a mantra, find my guru, find some way to healing. And so it was like within a couple of weeks, I went from quite crazy and deluded to, okay, back to, I get it. Now I see the right path.
Okay.
And you know, I moved into the Shivananda Yoga Center in Manhattan, and I started doing yoga, and I started meditating. Once I discovered meditation, I was able to stop smoking marijuana completely, because now I had a spiritual path. It was just, I didn't learn it. I tried it once, and I went, oh, my God, that's it. This is it, meditation. This is the best. And so then I would get my glow, and I would get my energy, and I would get my divine experience, and I had some amazing experiences. You know, I had divine beings walking through the wall of the meditation room, entering my body and blazing Shakti into the room. And I had several experiences of this kind. So it was like, this is the real thing. Meditation is all I need. I don't need that delusion. Don't thank you. I quit weed. Eventually, about a year later, I was able to quit smoking cigarettes also. You know, in my crazy days, I was hanging out on the streets of Manhattan with street characters. You know, and I met a guy who had just escaped from a mental hospital, and I invited him home to my little apartment and gave him a space to live for several months. So I had many adventures in New York, but I was, you know, I just had a lot of cleaning up to do. But once I understood what the path was and what my place on it was, suddenly I went from crazy to sane. And very soon, you know, met a saint from India who had come, and there, I met a young woman who was very attractive and sort of winked at me and said she would love to have a partner to study A Course in Miracles with. And by the way, would you like to learn tantric sex? And so I ended up saying yes to this. I mean, how could I not? And so, you know, went up to Massachusetts to live with her. And so we lived together for a couple of years, and we did the tantric sex thing, which was very beneficial.
And the Course in Miracles, right?
It was very good. And we studied the Course in Miracles
okay.
for a couple of years. So I did the full, I read the whole thing. And we had a discussion group, and it was very, very healing and beneficial for me to bring in, to you know, just discover that spiritual teaching.
And where were you in Massachusetts? This is just a curiosity question.
Oh, gosh, we were near Northampton.
Northampton, okay.
But I think we were in
North Hadley.
Right next to one of the colleges.
Okay, not my area. I used to live in Massachusetts, this is why I asked, but I was
okay.
I was out a little more west than that, so not
okay.
my area.
Eventually I moved west.
Did
I
you?
I moved out to, I can't remember the names of these towns, but we were up in the mountains.
Oh, okay, so you moved way west then, if you were in the mountains. Yeah. I was in between the two places where you lived, I think.
Okay.
All right, so before we go on then, I'd like to stop and talk about A Course in Miracles, if that's okay.
Sure.
So you said you studied it for 2 years. Did you do the workbook?
Yes, I did.
You did the lessons.
I did the lessons, and I did the whole teacher's manual also.
Okay. Now I know that A Course in Miracles was, I think you described it to Rick as something like helpful but not your path.
I think the essence of it is still very much with me.
Okay.
But ultimately, the language of it, I felt drawn finally towards Advaita, towards non-duality. So it's the teachings of Ramana Maharshi. This was a big pull for me.
Yeah, well, that's
my
guru.
Is always looking for absolute oneness.
Yeah, Ramana. I also went through A Course in Miracles and then was drawn to Ramana Maharshi. So
okay.
we have that in common. Well, I haven't made it to Amma, so we'll talk about her. But what I would like to know before we move on is, what about A Course in Miracles? You said some of it has stuck with you. So what would you say has stuck with you? What essence of Course in Miracles is there right now?
Well, I can give you what, for me, I say is the essence of the course in just a couple of sentences. For me, the essence is that really there is nothing but Christ everywhere. And everyone and everything is really nothing but a manifestation of Christ. And if I have chosen to believe otherwise, if I have chosen to think that someone is other than Christ and has done something wrong, that's my mistake. That's my illusion. And so forgiveness is the process of removing my mistake. And going, well, I imagined that you did something wrong, but now all I see the truth is that you are actually only Christ, and that you've always been only Christ, and that we are actually that one Christ self, and let's join together and celebrate our true identity, which is perfect oneness.
Okay, beautiful. That's beautiful. Beautiful synopsis. All right, then let's go ahead and continue with your story.
Okay. Now, if you would like, I can share with you an invocation which I wrote after I had been studying the course for a couple of years, and I was working with it in meditation for some time. Would you like to hear
this? I would love that.
All right. It's kind of like an open, it's an invocation which has blanks in it. So if you're working on forgiving somebody, you can put their name into the blank, and you can put your own name into the blank. You can put your father, mother in the blank, whatever. But maybe since I'm here with you, I'll put your name into it.
That's
okay, Regina?
Fine. Yeah.
All right. Invocation for forgiveness and eternal joining to all beings. I love you, Regina, my God self, with all my heart and with all my mind and with all my strength and with all my soul. I bless you with my boundless joy in our eternal love and consummate union in the light of God. And by the omnipotent grace and gentle power of that sacred radiant love who is our home, I now forgive us both all imagined imperfections and sanctify us both. We are pure divine reflections, completely in all ways and forever. With a loving offering of my entire being, I bow to you, Regina, and give myself completely unto the God within you, who is you. I kneel in awe and blissful gratitude before the sacred altar of your human holiness, and by the power of the Christ within me, who I am and who you also are, I now reopen my heart's eye and envision you anew, that I may receive myself in the mirror of your wholeness and re-enter the heaven of our oneness. Oh, oh, my beloved Regina, my beloved self, in all you are and have ever been, I see you as one with God, a beautiful, radiant Christ, a blazing sun of love and power and peace, the tender eternal being aglow within my heart. Within all forms, within each thought, and in every single moment, art thou, my divine beloved, in sweet disguise. For this entire creation is made and pervaded by you, sweet friend. Yes, the universe is wholly one, a joyous, praise-filled temple of the living God thou truly art. O glorious, blissful spirit, my omnipresent divine lover, thou the cosmic Satguru, and I am free, for I am you. I feel your total love for me, your pure, omniscient ecstasy. The one true self is thine, Regina, and mine, shining crystalline through all, pervading all the time. Thou, the bearer of my salvation, and the healer and the savior of everyone. O my holy, holy one, in the joyously dancing flame of life and truth and ecstatic love, that sacred space where two souls merge, ablaze with light in the violet heart of our one Christ self, I merge with you, Regina. And now and forever, my beloved, my guru, my Lord, we are one. We are God. We are home. Om. Om.
Beautiful. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, that was
so cool. I was using that as a daily meditation. And with this, you know, working with forgiving everybody I'd ever known, myself especially, I suppose. And so this led to it was part of a big purification, which prepared me for meeting Alma.
All right, so let's then go on with the next chapter of your life. Let's talk about how you left the tantric sex and A Course in Miracles and moved on.
So I heard, at one point in our lives together, I suddenly realized, you know what, I kind of had enough of the sex thing. It was like, this is nice, and I feel like I've eaten a very rich meal. It's like I'm full, and I don't really want any more food right now. What I want is God realization. Of course, I'm reading Autobiography of the Yogi and reading the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, and feeling like I'm being called to become a monk. I want to become like one of these yogis I'm reading about. And so we went together to a weekend workshop at a Buddhist monastery. And one of the nuns there, and I said to her, you know, I would love to be a monk with him in India. And she said, oh, there's a saint coming from India in a few months. We've heard she's really special. Why don't you go and see her? So I took down the information, and then when the day came, I drove into Boston to meet this woman who turned out to be Amma. And so this is quite beautiful and quite fascinating, and they're singing devotional songs, and it's very, very fascinating and attractive. And at the end, I go up in a little queue, on your knees, and you get up close to her, and a few feet away from her, I start feeling this heat in my body, like this energy radiating into me. And then she pulls me into her arms and gives me a very warm and intimate hug, and looks very deeply into my eyes for several seconds, and then takes her finger and dips it in sandal paste and puts it on my third eye for just a few seconds. And I feel this lightning flash in my brain. And then she gives me a piece of candy and another brief hug, and then that's it. And I'm going to sit down and I'm eating the I'm eating the candy and the flower petals at once, and I'm like, oh my God, this is quite amazing. What's going on here? And my brain is still flashing. And I'm going, well, this is pretty awesome. I better take this seriously. There's an opportunity to come back tomorrow and ask for permission. I can ask her about becoming a monk. So I said, oh, so let me sleep over in my car and go on 6 foot work the next day. So I'm up all night long with this lightning show blazing in my head. Apparently, it's her finger on my forehead. Didn't get much sleep. And the next morning, there was no place. I didn't even think to wash my face. I didn't take a shower. And so I've still got the sandal paste on my forehead from the night before. Well, I go to the program, and there's about 30 people in the room. It was her first year. And I thought, well, you know, why don't I just sit here and watch everybody else going up and imagine when they're on Amma's lap that I'm also getting that hug. And so then I said, this is a good idea. So then I'm sitting there watching and I'm imagining that I'm receiving all these hugs. So after about, I've had 28 hugs in my imagination, and I'm really in just already in a bliss state. So then when I go up to Amma, she looks at the sandal paste on my forehead from the night before, and she says, oh, already had darshan. Darshan refers to the hug. And I said, no, this is from last night. And she kind of gave me a look as well. We don't know if he's cheating or not, but we'll give him a hug anyway. So I'm like, so she gives me a hug, and I'm thinking, well, you know, if she really didn't know that she hadn't already hugged me this morning, then this is not my guru, because I know my guru, whoever it is an omniscient being. Is, you know, I'm having all this communion from an omniscient being who's guiding me. I know that my guru is not a fool that doesn't realize what she's just done. So if this is not, if this, she didn't really know, then she's not my guru. But then I sat down and I realized, well, maybe she was telling me that she knew I had been sitting out in the audience receiving all those hugs in my imagination, and therefore I had already had darshan. But it was like too much for me to get in that moment. It was like, what do you mean? Would she be actually kind of fooling me? Would she be not showing me her divinity, but actually kind of disguising it and seeing if I could see through her disguise into the goddess behind? I mean, it was like too much for me to kind of grasp it. And I was left me with a doubt. Well, did she really know or didn't she? You know, I really couldn't quite get it. So I was left with a bit of a doubt. But I went up afterwards and got into the question line. And I told the Swami sitting next to her, I want to become a sannyasin. It means a Hindu monk. And this was translated out loud for everyone to hear. That's how they did it the first year. Now they're not doing that anymore, for obvious reasons. Questions like that should be private. But anyway, it was translated to Amma and translated to everyone. And Amma looks over at me while she's giving somebody else a hug, of course. And she looks over at me and she hears this and she starts giggling. And she starts laughing and laughing and laughing. And she's laughing harder than I've ever seen anyone laugh in my entire life. And meanwhile, I'm blushing red as a bee. And she gasps out, you? And she laughs again. It was the funniest thing. And she's rolling in laughter, giving the person on her lap this wild ride. And then finally she says, there's a name for the kind of sannyasin you would be. In India, when a newly married husband has his first quarrel with his wife, sometimes he'll say, I'm leaving you and renouncing the world. And he'll put on orange robes and go off into the community. And within a couple of days, he's winking at all the women in town and making all kinds of mischief. That's the kind of sannyasin you'd be. And then she said, you have a mind like a cat. No matter how much you feed it, it will always be feeling something. Now, so this was a pretty serious, in-your-face humbling in front of a bunch of people. My very first meeting with her, it was like, okay, well, I felt she must know me very deeply to know that I'm strong enough to handle this. And she's basically slapping me right across the face and laughing at me in front of everybody, you know? It's exactly the opposite of what you'd think a saint who wanted you to become her devotee would be doing. She's not being nice at all, really. You know, but there was a sense afterwards that, you know, they say, like, there's a saying in India that when a potter is molding a vase and he slaps the outside of it, he'll put his other hand inside to receive the force of the blow. So it was my sense somehow that maybe she put her other hand inside me to receive that slap and filled me with a certain kind of grace. It was like she planted a seed of devotion which began to grow after this program. And as I was leaving, I said, you know what, I'm not really accepting this no from her. I'm not in the mood to just accept, no, you're not, your life's dream is not going to happen. You're not going to become a monk. I don't care. I want a sign from God. So I'm driving home, and I'm asking for a sign. And I drive, I'm driving myself, and in every town I go through, I see a sign for Maple Street. And I'm seeing four Maple Streets, another one, five, six Maple Streets. Wait a minute, maybe this is a sign, Maple. What is that? Ah, and then it dawned on me, Maple. If you really want to become a monk, you may pull for that goal, and Amma will help you. So it was like, it was a message received from God. Okay, yes, I will pull for that goal. So I made the decision then and there, I'm going to try. I'm going to try to become a sannyasi. So within a couple of months, the relationship I was in kind of fell apart. And, you know, my girlfriend really didn't want to come to India except maybe to buy some clothes and run out after about a week. And I wanted to become a monk, and it just wasn't working out. So I moved up to live with some friends in Western Massachusetts and started increasing my meditation time to 4 hours a day and really wanted to get focused. I want this. I'm going to see Amma again when she comes next year, and I'm going to see if I can make the grade this time around. You know? And very soon I received a very powerful miracle. It's kind of a long story, but maybe I can sum it up very quickly.
Okay.
You know, I was chanting Amma's bhajans. I got a cassette tape from the program, and I was learning her bhajans, and I was trying her out as my guru, you know. And I decided, let me try, instead of cursing when things go wrong, let me try chanting God's name if things go wrong. Let me try to, you know, I was seeing this flaw in myself. So let me try, if I stub my toe, instead of cursing, let me try to remember God. Let me try to keep my spirits up. And I sort of made a resolve. Well, I had a job in a health food store about half an hour away. And I was a little late one morning, and so I'm getting into my car, and it's quite cold. There's snow all over the ground, and my car has very bald tires. It was a cheap old car. And a friend of mine had told me, listen, if you slide off the road on the ice, which happens quite a lot, what you need to do is put a jack in your car. And this way you can jack up the tire that's stuck, and that will pull you, that will put more weight on the other tires, and you'll be able to pull out. So I had put a jack in the car, and I put a bag of sand, and so I was all ready for the jack technique. Well, so this morning I go driving out a little faster than I probably should have been going because I was late, and it turns out there was an ice storm, and I didn't even notice it. And, the water, it had rained, and then the rain had frozen, and then it had gone to like 31 degrees. So the snow was just, the ice was just slightly melting. So it was like a slippery skating rink, the highway was. And I was going down, and I was turning, and was not at all affected by my turn in the steering wheel. And I jammed the brakes on, and the brakes had absolutely no effect. And I went sliding at full speed into a snowbank and went like, you know, 6 feet deep with both front tires into the snowbank. So I did curse when it first happened, but I said, okay, this is an opportunity to test my results. So, okay, fine. So I started singing one of Amma's bhajans, and I got the jack out of the trunk, and I opened up the sandbag and took one of my hubcaps and was using that as a shovel. The shovel passed for all the tires to come out, and I was putting sand underneath all the tires, jacked up the front left tires to put more. I didn't think it was going to be enough with both front tires stuck, but so I'm trying this, and I get it in the car, and vroom, 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 vroom. What happened? We just fell right off the jack and didn't even move one inch. And so I don't lose my spirits. I don't curse. I'm singing a bunch of Durge, 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 Jai Jai Ma. So I go back to the trunk again, and I keep doing it. I keep digging out more snow, and I'm putting more sand, and I keep singing. And I do this 10 times, and then after about an hour, I've got snow in my boots, and I'm starting to shiver, and I'm kind of like, you know, it's kind of ready to give up on this and just walk back home and leave the car here, you know. But let me try one more time. So I go to the trunk again for the 11th time, and sitting on top of the sandbag that I had been shoveling from for an hour was a brand new jack. Mm. And wedged into one hinge of the jack was a piece of candy. And I was like, oh my God, a miracle. It was such obviously like a biblical miracle. This is incredible. I can't believe it. So I ate the candy, filled with joy. My first things first, right? And then I took this new jack and I jacked up the right front tire. So now both of them are jacked up and was able to pull out back into the road. So, when I got home, I realized, wow, these jacks were symbolic, right? The first one represented my own efforts on the path. Well, the second one obviously represented the grace of the guru.
Yes.
And it was when the two were combined that I would be able to pull out of the snowbank of samsara.
I love that. When the two are combined, I'm able to pull out of the snowbank of samsara. That's gorgeous. Now, what about the piece of candy? What?
I ate it.
But I mean, does that have any significance at all? Other than, oh good, there's a piece of candy.
Well, you know, the fact that Amma, when you go up to receive a hug from her, she gives you a piece of candy.
Yes.
It was, it seemed to me very clearly like a signature on it. You know,
okay.
That this had come from Amma. It did not, you know, without the candy, okay, very unusual occurrence, but the candy made it clearly a miracle.
Okay, you know? So that was the signature, so you knew that the miracle came from Amma. So I'm assuming you finally got to go see her again. What happened when you saw her the next time?
Yeah, the next time I said, okay, I'm going to spend 8 days with her. And I wasn't, you know, the fact that I had received this miracle and I had been practicing devotion to her, still it was like I was not yet ready to claim her as my guru. You know, it was one of those things where it was such a big decision. I knew it was a big decision. I wanted to be 100% sure. So I'm coming to these programs and, you know, receiving her embrace, and I was find myself bursting into tears for like 2 or 3 days in a row, because it was like in her presence I would be rising into this gorgeous vibration and this beautiful peace and perfect love. And then in the lunch break between the programs, I would see myself falling right back into the ego. And then coming back into her presence in the ego state was so painful that I burst into tears several times. And I felt like she was working with me, you know, kneading me like a piece of pizza dough. And I began to get this subterranean kind of feeling, you know, wow, this is impressive. I mean, maybe she really is my guru, you know, but I wasn't quite ready to say so yet. And then we went to Boston, and who came to see her? Ram Dass, the famous American teacher. And his books have been among the first that really opened me up to spirituality. And I had accepted his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, a very powerful master, as my granddaddy guru. It wasn't that he was my guru. I didn't feel that, but I felt he was going to guide me to my guru. This was kind of like a contract, you know?
Okay.
And so then when I see Ram Dass on Amma's lap, and Amma's playing with him and putting flower petals on his head, and everybody's laughing, suddenly it dawned on me, wow, Ram Dass is, Neem Karoli Baba and Amma are one. It was just like a flash. Oh. Look at that. It must be so. And then we were in a church, and there was a banner of the cross. Oh, Amma and Jesus are one. And the Holy Spirit. Amma and the Holy Spirit are one. Amma is the embodiment of all the masters you've ever prayed to. Yes, she is your guru. She is God incarnate, and she is here for you. This is why you've come to the earth. And so I'm getting this, oh my God, I'm just so much wanted to be called by her. It's like, yes, I get it. She's my guru. Like the universal license plate is flashing to me. Yes, she's your guru. And that's fine, but shouldn't she call me? Right? So I get on the darshan line with this burning desire to be called by her and go up and receive her embrace finally. And she whispers in my ear, join us.
Mm.
No trace of Indian accent there, just pure join us, you know. And, you know, joining is, as you know, it's a very important word in the Course in Miracles. And it's hard to describe what it was like when those two words came into me. It was kind of like a bomb went off. It was like end of old life, beginning of new life. Mm-hmm. It was a confirmation that she was the divine incarnate. It's hard to explain how I knew that. It wasn't a mind thing. It was bigger than that. It was like, okay, she has called me. The joining has happened. I belong to her and with her forever. This is my guru. This is the reason for my life. And the old life is gone now. A new life has dawned. You know, so this was a very huge, and it was this huge revelation of love. And in a way, it was also, it was like, now the whole thing I've been through with my crazy Messiah trip and all of that makes some sense. Now I get it. I have indeed been called for something very big and important, and her name is Amma, and it's all about this is why I've come, and this is my path forward.
All right.
So it was a very big night.
Okay, so now in a way you have another new start. So with this new start, because you've had other new starts before now, but with this new start, you know, what phase did you enter into? How is this helpful to your goal that I heard you state earlier of self-realization?
Well, it gave me tremendous focus. You know, it gave me tremendous amount of clarity. I immediately started writing songs to Amma, devotional songs. And I think I wrote 30 in the first year. And I traveled out to California to her satsang group there, and I met some friends there who said, yes, you can come and live on our land for free. I didn't have any money. And so I had a cabin in the woods with made a big altar and started meditating 4 hours a day there and chanting to Amma all day long, recorded the tape of songs and poetry, and told everybody all about my new name and all about Amma's life. And I sent it out to like 100 people at Christmas time, including grandma and all the aunts and uncles and all the family friends who would never understand and would be gossiping. And I said, oh, fine, let me just tell them all, here it is. This is why I'm changing my name. I love you. You don't have to understand me, but I'm just doing my best to share with you what's going on here. You know, I've discovered this God incarnate on the earth here, and I'm telling you all about it. It's kind of fun.
And may I ask, why Ram Dass?
Why the name Ram Dass? Well, it was a few days after this big awakening that happened in Boston. Maybe it was just 2 days later, we went up to New Hampshire. And I asked her, towards the end of the Darshan program, I asked her for a name. And she gave me the name Ram Dass.
Okay. And the last name, is that the same last name you've always had?
Yes, that's the name from birth.
Okay.
So that's just my author name at this point, Ram Dass Batchelder, to connect the old and the new. It's also good to distinguish myself from the famous Ram Dass, so people don't think I'm trying to steal his thunder by signing my books Ram Dass with a slightly different spelling. That would be fake, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, of course, he's not the first Ram Dass either, so.
That's true.
So, yeah. It is funny, though, when we had Nikki interview you before, one of our members was getting all ready to post the audio, you know, expecting the audio to be a good audio, and he did not know that you were a different Ram Dass. So the picture that he had was of, you know, Richard Albert.
Yeah.
So I guess
I love him, and his books have been very helpful for me, and I met him several times. So I'm happy to be associated with him.
Did Amma ever give any indication as to why the name Ram Dass?
Well, no, but you know, after I first awakened a little bit to the Hindu masters, one of the first things I did was I bought a cassette tape of bhajans, these devotional chants, to Rama, to Sri Rama. Rama is one of the great incarnations of God in India, and whose life story is enshrined in the Ramayana, which is like his great devotional poem. So I was singing I learned all of them by heart, so I was constantly singing to Rama. Who knows why? But so then it sort of seemed appropriate that she would give me this name. It just happened.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I think also maybe a clue that my life might have some similarities to this other Ram Dass. You know, I've turned out to be a spiritual author. This is my sixth book. And it's all about communicating spirituality to people and making them laugh.
Mm.
So we have very similar destinies.
Yes, yes. Okay, so one of the things that I'm really interested in, you know, like once upon a time, there was a guy named Mark who had a strong sense of self and didn't know any different, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and now I'm assuming that you are in a different place. Maybe your sense of self somehow is fading. Is that true?
Well, I can think you could say maybe it's expanded.
Okay.
It's expanded a lot into the divine self.
Okay.
That's my meditation. That's like my meditation is starts out with basically, you know, I'm not a person, I'm not this body, I'm not the mind, I'm not Ram Dass, I'm not this spiritual seeker, author, character. That's not at all what I am. I am the totality of the divine. I am the infinite supreme self, which is the true self of all beings. And I go right into substantial amount of detail into what that is, going layer by layer, expanding into that. And then go beyond the mind, go beyond the imagination and affirmation into the direct experience of pure being.
And so, and have you experienced beyond the mind?
Sure. I mean, you know, the beyond, that's a daily kind of thing. The beyond the mind is actually at the root of the mind. You know, it's always with us. The supreme silence is not something really far away that we have to attain. It's actually our own true nature. It's hiding inside the I thought.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that I discovered, well, maybe about a year ago. A very profound discovery. I could just quickly share it with you.
Please.
I saw, you know, I saw on Facebook a post about the physical atoms are 99.99999999999% space. They look like something solid, but when you get in there with an electron microscope, this vast space opens up, and then these teeny-weeny little particles floating around that space, they give it some appearance of solidity. But actually, there's nothing there but space. And it just occurred to me, I bet the I thought is exactly the same.
Mm.
It appears to be something solid, but if you look really closely in meditation, it's completely empty. And what is that emptiness? That is pure awareness, which is the nature of the supreme reality.
Okay, so you said if you look at it very, very deeply in meditation, how did you go about looking at it very deeply in meditation?
Well, it's, you know, it's the question, who am I? The question, who am I, of Ramana Maharshi,
yeah.
Just keeps coming back to that one question and keep examining this I that asserts itself and claims to be something solid. You keep challenging that solidity and looking at it and saying, wait a minute, who are you? What is this I? Who am I? Who am I really? Let me see. Is there somebody there or not? What is that? Then you can be sort of pulled behind the I thought, or rather pulled inside it into the innermost essence. And that innermost essence is perfect silence. It's untouched by any trace of thought. It exists prior to the thought, I. Thought is that little particle that spins around outside of it, but in the innermost essence, there's nothing there but pure being that's inherently untouched by any thought. No concept, no imagination, no effort. There's nobody to make effort there. It's just pure, pure being. And that, it turns out, is the only reality. It's the supreme reality itself. And the I thought, everything from the I thought on out, which means the whole realm of perception, the whole realm of mind, is an illusion. It's a mirage, and it really doesn't exist at all. What absolutely does exist is that perfect silence, that perfect peace, the ultimate stillness, and just pure awareness without a subject or an object that's always right there in the innermost essence of your own I thought. That's what you are, and it is infinite, eternal, timeless, changeless, permanent, indivisible. Nothing but that has ever really existed. And
okay.
It's completely free. There's no bondage, no suffering, no duality, no separation, no individual, no desire, no fear, no anger, nothing but pure being, and it's of the nature of supreme peace and bliss.
Okay, then I have a question for you.
Yes.
What are angels? What is Amma? What is Ramana Maharshi? If inside is nothing,
right.
What are these things in manifestation that we experience as pointers, maybe?
Sure. Well, you know, it's like there's a saying in India that the guru is like the lion that appears in the dream of the elephant that wakes the elephant up. Once the elephant wakes up, well, the dream is gone, the lion is gone. But in the dream of the elephant, the lion plays a very important role because it wakes the lion up. But once the lion wakes up, well, the lion is gone because it was just a dream.
So Amma, Ramana Maharshi, the angel that you met, they are all then a manifestation of that space. Would that be true?
Yes. I mean, they are absolutely all a manifestation of the supreme reality.
Yes.
And in fact, everything is nothing but a manifestation of the supreme reality. So, you know, you can talk about one level, you can talk about Brahman, okay, it's like, of course, when you start talking about it's like something, you're already in the realm of thought.
I understand. We're having a discussion, so
Brahman
we have to.
Is like an infinite diamond of pure awareness.
Yes.
And the whole realm of manifestation is like a little mirage which appears within a little portion of that diamond. So the mirage includes the creator, creation of billions of universes, and all the avatars, saints and sages, are part of that mirage, as well as all the criminals, and everything else that's going on, all manifestation is within that little mirage which exists within the diamond of divinity. Now, the diamond is the one and only reality underneath and within all the changing names and forms and events in that mirage of duality. So, in other words, Brahman is the one reality of all appearances. But if you inquire, who is it that perceives the realm of duality? Who perceives Ama? Who perceives angels or news events or things that are happening in the world? Who perceives this individual? Okay, the answer comes, I perceive. Who is this I? Who am I? That question pulls you inside the I thought Adam, into the pure awareness that's the innermost essence of that Adam. And that pure awareness is the diamond itself. That's the nature of the diamond. And since it exists prior to the I thought, there's nobody left to perceive the realm of duality. Only the I can perceive duality. When the I is gone, or in this case transcended, you've gone behind it, then there's no more perception. There's no more, the realm of duality disappears, including the individual, including the guru, including the world, including God. And what remains is nothing but the supreme reality, which is Brahman. It's absolutely indivisible. There's no duality there at all. There's no time, no space, no separation. None of that has ever existed. So that we can call Brahman. Okay, the diamond in relation to the mirage, we can call Brahman. But something which I fairly recently discovered, which is another level up, if you can come with me this far,
I can come with you.
This is called Parabrahman.
Yes.
And I never believed in Parabrahman. For me, Brahman is enough. If you really know what Brahman is, that's it. Why are we talking about Parabrahman? It's ridiculous. Para means supreme. It's like, well, yeah, but Brahman is already supreme. We don't need to talk about this. But fairly recently, I just contemplated, well, let's see. You know, we could talk about Brahman in relation to the creator and the creation, and like that. Like, you know, Sri Ramakrishna said that Kali and Brahman are inseparable, like fire and its power to burn. And, you know, the creator manifests as the creation. So in a way, Brahman has manifested as the creation. And so we can talk about Brahman in relationship to a creation and a creator. But in Parabrahman, nothing but Parabrahman has ever existed.
Yes.
And so you cannot talk about it in relation to anything at all. There is no creator, no creation, no time, no space, no deities, no guru, no individual, no mind. And that is, in fact, the only reality. Ramana Maharshi had a term for this. Ajata means no creation. There has never been a creation. That's the ultimate reality. Brahman, Parabrahman, remains forever as it is, and that is what you are, and it's absolute freedom, and it's what you are right now. And nothing but that has ever existed. Now, if you can taste that in meditation as yourself, and realize and experience what it is to be that incredible bliss of infinite, timeless, indivisible being, well, that's incredible bliss. And the fact that there nothing else has ever existed is like, wow, total freedom and nothing but this has ever, it cleans the mind completely. You know, of any trace of spiritual concept, it all burns to ashes and nothing remains but perfect freedom and peace. It's amazing.
So all parts of the ego disappear, as well as all parts of the spiritual path disappears.
That's right.
Everything.
I found it to be incinerating every trace of spiritual concept that I've ever cherished.
Yes.
Oh, you believe in karma, reincarnation, dharma, the grace of the guru, you know, forget it. I'm sorry, none of it has ever existed. Turn on the incinerator, Parabrahman alone is real, that is what you are, and nothing but that has ever existed.
Yes.
There are no others, there is only this, and it's the one self. Of course, you know, wow. It's the true self of all beings, but there have never been any beings. There's only this one.
Yes.
So, you know, if you can taste it and experience it, then it's fantastic. If you're hearing it and going, thinking of it as something other than you, then it could be kind of scary. Because from the ego's perspective,
right,
it's like, are you going to tell me that everything I think I am has never existed? Excuse me, that's a little too scary for me. Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, give me back my deity, please. You know, I want my dharma and my karma and my mantra. Thank you. So, these things all have their place on the path, but you know, the individual has to sort of carefully, you get to that very slowly, to a place where you sort of gradually convince your mind that the nothing behind the mind, which is, you know, they say that's the supreme reality, that space of pure awareness where no thought has ever existed, you sort of gradually convince your mind that that is not your annihilation, it's your glory.
And so you convince the mind then not to be afraid to allow the going there to happen.
That's right. Yes. That's right. So that's kind of what my meditation is about, is sort of gently enticing the mind with bliss and joy and to enter that space where there is absolutely nothing but consciousness itself, and discover that that is actually not your annihilation, it's not your extinction, it's your fulfillment and your glory, and it's the supreme reality, and congratulations, you've made it. You know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in the Tao, it says that the Tao is before God. So this is what you have just described.
Of course, it's the essence of what God really is.
Yes, but God, you know, we all know, you know, God usually starts with the idea of creator. Right.
This is before the duality of creator and creation.
Yes, yes.
Of Father and Son. And it was to that absolute oneness that my heart was so drawn. This is why the language of the Course, which is, you know, the Father and the Son, didn't fully satisfy me. It just, I've probably been on this non-duality path for many lifetimes, and so that was just like I was just being pulled to it like a magnet, you know?
Yeah, no, I understand, because I, like you, I studied the Course for, I may have done it for 3 or 4 years, I don't remember how long, but the Course for me was a, you know, it was a starter. It was a push, is what the Course was. It was a push. And in my personal experience, you spoke to an angel. In my personal experience, Ramana Maharshi, I say, woke up in me, came alive in me, and started teaching me. And I did not know who Ramana Maharshi was, so that was a pretty unique experience. Of course, now I do. And I've heard you mention Ramana Maharshi, and I've heard you mention Amma. And I know that Amma is the one that you are, if you'll pardon these words, most devoted to. Is that somewhat of a fair statement?
She's my Sadguru. She's my Sadguru. You know? So that's a very special relationship.
Yes.
It's a very, my love and my full commitment is to her. But I know that Amma and Ramana Maharshi are not separate.
Okay. That's the way I tell people, because of course
it's the same supreme being in two different forms, giving two different teachings and very apparently different kind of manifestations, but it's the same supreme reality in two forms.
So I'm obviously very familiar with A Course in Miracles, and I'm very familiar with Ramana Maharshi, other than the reputation of she's the hugging saint, and other than, you know, I know some about her great, great, great charitable works, you know, that huge organization that just helps everywhere. But Amma herself, you're like, just now when I asked you about this experience of finding, I'll call it the space within the eye. And I asked you how you did that or what helped you towards that. You mentioned the who am I. You went back to Ramana Maharshi. What I'm curious about are what are Amma's teachings? What are Amma's teachings that point one towards self-realization?
Well, you know, there are so many different paths. And generally speaking, Amma's outer teaching is focused on devotion.
Okay.
A devotion to God, and it's focused on service and compassion for humanity and, you know, developing qualities like dedication and sincerity and bringing your devotion into action on a daily basis. Stuff that, you know, anybody can just kind of jump in and do that. I mean, anybody can go out there, okay, I can pick up a sponge and clean tables, and maybe I can also chant the name of God while I do that. And maybe I can practice being kind to the people around me and remembering that God is doing all this and we're living within God, and remembering that our goal is God realization here, so let me remember and see if I can open my heart. So that's something that anyone can jump into that, you know? And so she's here. You know, Amma says something like that the path of jnana, which is the path of wisdom that Ramana Maharshi taught, is suitable for only 1%. Can the Divine Mother leave all the others out? You know, so she's come for the 99% who find the jnana path to be just inaccessible. It's too difficult. And yet, for me, you know, after I was with her and fell completely in love with her and was just overwhelmed by her divinity and by her omniscience and by the guidance that she was giving me, it was just incredible. I was so in love. After a couple of years of very intense devotional practices with her, I felt her say to me, start self-inquiry.
Okay, yeah.
And I was like, wait a minute, what do you mean? That's a jnana practice. I'm on the bhakti path, aren't I, Amma? And I looked down, and we were in a puja at the time, and there was a piece of newspaper where flower petals had been piled up for use in the puja. And it was now, the flower petals were now emptied, and there was a image of railway tracks on the newspaper in an advertisement or something. And I understood that jnana and bhakti are like the two tracks of a railway track.
Yes.
Both are needed. So you should practice both.
Yeah,
absolutely. Don't drop your devotion. Begin the contemplation and begin the practice of who am I, and see if you can get to the root of that mystery.
Yeah, when I, as I mentioned, I met Ramana Maharshi within instead of through books. And as you can imagine, meeting from within, you know, you might get a different understanding than through books. But Ramana Maharshi from within was very, very clear that, you know, like self-inquiry may be the way, but devotion is the how. You don't do self-inquiry without the devotion.
Right. I mean, the devotion really is the ground.
Yes.
It really is. In fact,
yes.
People who came to Ramana Maharshi for the first time, he would often give them the Lalita Sahasranamam, which or the something, it's an invocation that begins that long prayer to the Divine Mother. So he would start out, seek the grace of the Divine Mother before you begin.
Yeah.
So, devotion and jnana are not two. They're really one.
Yes, I agree.
Two sides of the same coin. The devotion leads to jnana, and jnana without devotion really doesn't lead anywhere.
Exactly.
It has to be for love.
Well, in fact, Ramana Maharshi, of course, he had a very short spiritual life before his awakening, as you know, very short. But that very short spiritual life was having his heart blown open when he read a book about all of the saints that were devoted to Shiva. So the devotion actually came first for him. And then during the awakening experience, then the inquiry came. But they were
and
both
then,
there.
Even after his enlightenment, he was a devotee of Arunachala,
Shiva,
the mountain.
Madly in love.
And he wrote beautiful poems of devotion, you know, like the garland of bridal poetry, like, you know, you are my wife kind of letters to Arunachala Shiva.
Yes.
So he was a devotee till the end, even though he had merged and become one with that. Still, when the slightest trace of duality is there, it manifests as infinite devotion.
Yeah. What would spirituality be without love?
Nothing.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I recently read a book of a person who is enlightened, and I actually never declare when people are or aren't. I stay out of that business. So I can just say, you know, they're said to be enlightened. Except in Ramana Maharshi, I might get in that business because of my inner experience. But other than that, I stay out of the business of declaring. But this one person that I recently read was very, very clear in his writing that love had nothing to do with enlightenment. And it was, you know, I read the entire book and much of what he said, you know, resonated, but the love having nothing to do with it. And he didn't experience a lot of love or bliss, and something just felt like half baked there to me. I don't know.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I suppose it could be said from a certain strange angle, but I would rather not go there, you know, I mean, ultimately, that, you know, one of the qualities of that supreme Parabrahman for me is indivisible, infinite love, oneness.
Yes.
It's not the love of a you and a me.
Yes, I understand.
It's love where there's only one. It's love in its initial, original form, which is indivisible. You know, and so to the extent that I imagine myself even a hair separate from that, then the love and the yearning is extremely intense. When I merge in that and discover that to be myself, I guess the word love doesn't apply anymore because there's no two there, but it's the greatest expression of love to be in that oneness.
Yes.
So I would never take the word love out of the picture.
Or joy. It seems joy is very natural as well to me. Happiness, joy, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. We have, you know, we have around 15 minutes left. And let me see if I think I have asked you all of the questions that I was listening, as I mentioned, to your Buddha at the Gas Pump interview, and I made notes of things that I wanted to ask, and I think we've covered all of it.
Okay.
So what would you like to tell me that I haven't asked you?
Well, I would just love to tell you more about Amma.
Okay, I knew you were going to say that.
I finished a six-week tour of the USA with Amma. And she's running on superhuman energy. There's no doubt about this. You know, I'll just describe what just happened in New York yesterday, which is very typical of what she does. She comes out in the morning at about 10 o'clock, gives hugs until 3 p.m., and this is after a meditation and some chanting. She gives hugs until 3 p.m., then she leaves the hall, and during the time that she's away from the hall, she visits VIPs. There might be some movie stars and some politicians, and she'll be giving them all hugs. She comes back to the hall at 7 p.m. and begins a program which goes all night long until 10 a.m. the next morning. And during that entire program, she does not take a bathroom break. Now, I'm going to the bathroom 7 times during that period, and she's blazing with energy, hugging everybody in that hall. And, you know, at 10 a.m., after she's hugged everybody, she stands up with flower petals and throws them, and people can walk in front of the stage, and she throws them on everybody, giving them a blessing. And then she stands there radiating divine energy and light in this just extraordinary display of divinity. You know, meanwhile, I'm sitting in my chair falling asleep at 4 a.m., you know, and she's just blazing with energy all night long. And what was also really cool in New York was that at 3 a.m., the rapper Doug E. Fresh came on and gave a rousing rap show and got everybody up dancing. And then Dinosaur Jr. came on and gave an amazing electric guitar set with really intense rock and roll riffs on the guitar, you know, combined with devotional singing. And everybody's just dancing like crazy. And we had several men, I guess they were gay or transsexual, wearing dresses and all made up in fancy makeup, dancing in the front like full freedom. And it was just a beautiful expression of we are all welcome and we're all, we don't have to become Indian. Man, we are welcome in Amma's arms. And we are, and she was just beaming love and joy during this whole thing, you know. It was one of the most beautiful programs of the summer. But she does the same kind of all-night program every stop we go, all summer long. And, you know, after the program, she gets in her van, and they drive up to Toronto. And the next day, she's doing another program starting at 10 a.m. Now, if she cared about her body, she'd fly. You know, I think most people would fly. But she just drives all the way along and then stops halfway through with the group of staff members, which is like 200 people. And they gather together at some beautiful lake. In this case, they stopped at Niagara Falls and had shared a meal and they sang bhajans. And she gives them all another special experience and then gets in her van and boom, 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 drives all the way to Toronto. I don't know if she's able to get sleep in that van or not. But it's the way she lives day by day is the most impressive manifestation of divinity. You just can't watch her for a week and come away thinking that she's not divine.
Right.
She's just running on a totally different set of batteries. I don't think it's batteries. I think she's just completely plugged in. She is the universal being itself masquerading in a human form.
Yeah, that's the image that I had as you were speaking of her, was plugged in, you know, to the universal energy that would give her the energy to do whatever she is to do. You know, there's just no doubt about that. When it asks you to do something, it gives you everything you need to do it.
That's right.
It doesn't leave you without. So, yeah. But what else about Amma? You know, do you have any personal experiences that really give us an idea of what she's like when she's not on stage?
Oh, there have been so many years of experiences. It's hard to come up with an example. Maybe I can come up with something. Gosh, you know, in the old days at the ashram, we used to do seva, which was called sand seva, because the property where she was born was full of ponds, and she wanted to fill in all those ponds with sand so we could build buildings there. And so every afternoon, a large canoe full of sand would deposit its load on one side of the island, and in the evening we'd go out after dinner and cart the sand from the dumping place over to one of the ponds and dump it in, one tray at a time. And we'd have hundreds of people out there working until past midnight. And Amma would be right out there with us, working along with us, digging with that shovel. And one day, I guess the brahmacharis forgot to do it. Like, they were there, the brahmacharis were meant to go out and do the sand seva, and Amma had given them the instruction, and somehow they missed it, or they forgot about it, or the instruction didn't get through. But anyway, it was like Amma's face took on a very dark look, like, if these boys do not care about my mission, then I will do it myself. And she marched out and began working all by herself and wouldn't let anybody help her. And then finally, you know, we all kind of went out there and walked along with her and started helping as best we could. But it was this sort of somber tone of, oh, my God, she's going to carry this entire mission on her head. You know, if we won't do it, she'll do it. And there was this sense, you know, then at midnight, when usually we would be served coffee and banana chips and we'd sing bhajans, she sat down in the sand and went into samadhi. And it was this awesome, deep silence. You know, it's a little scary when somebody goes into samadhi. It's like, wow, where did she go, you know? And, you know, meanwhile, her sari is all covered with mud and very impressive. You could just sense the huge importance of her mission, as if she is, you know, she's imbued with the healing nectar in a world where people are suffering so much. She knows how to cure their suffering, and it's her job, given by God, to save the world. She travels the world ceaselessly and is giving, you know, literally millions of people a direct taste of the divine. And she's doing this tirelessly with such a dedication. It's the most amazing thing. It really is incredible.
Well, thank you. Oops. I thought I heard my dog making a noise, but I guess not.
I should give you, end, I should give you the website where people can find my book.
Okay. I think we did that, but let's do that again.
Okay. www.rising-inlove.org.
Okay, rising-inlove.org.
Right. And there's also a website for learning more about Amma's charitable mission, which is an amazing thing to discover.
Okay.
That's called www.embracingtheworld.org.
Embracingtheworld.org. And if they donate to embracingtheworld.org, if they care about the taxes, is that a deductible in the United States?
It's tax deductible. It's fully tax deductible. I found that the easiest way to donate is to go to another website, which is www.amma.org, amma.org. There's a nice clear donate button there. I didn't find such an easy donate button on the embracingtheworld.org.
Okay, so two different choices, but the Amma has the easier donate button. Excellent.
Amma.org is easier.
And is Amma.org, if they wanted to know her travel schedule, is that also where they would go?
That's exactly right. That's where to go. That's the American Ashram website.
Okay.
That's an excellent website.
And where is the American Ashram?
Well, there are actually many of them now, but the primary one is in San Ramon, California, which is in the Bay Area.
Okay. Well, it has been an absolute delight speaking with you. You are a lot of fun to talk to. This hour and a half went by very quickly. So thank you.
Special.
Thank you for letting us know that you were in the States and available to try this again.
I'm so glad we could do a good interview. I felt so embarrassed about the other one.
Well, you know, it does. I mean, you know, I'm happy to talk to you again. However, we are, you know, we are in the business of accepting everything as perfect and allowing all things to be as it is. So.
Yes.
For us, it just was what it was. And
right.
Now it's come around and we got to have this conversation. So here we go.
Thanks, Regina.
All right.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you and great love.
Thank you. You too. God bless you.
God bless.
Too.
Bye.
Bye.